And life is seen as a journey also in various myths and various legends and various parables. And this brings us to tonight's subject, which is the myth, or the parable, if you like, of the return journey. And this is the second of the parables of the White Lotus Sutra. And it occurs in chapter 4 of that work. And in chapter 4, this parable is related not by the Buddha himself, not by the Shakyamuni, but by four great elders headed by Mahakashyapa. You may remember from previous weeks that these four great elders headed by Mahakashyapa have heard Sariputra's prediction to perfect Buddhahood. They've heard the Buddha tell everybody that Sariputra is now so far advanced on the path that he is sure he's almost destined to reach the end, to reach the goal, to reach the very highest goal of all, which is not just emancipation from one's own individual sin and suffering, but Buddhahood, supreme enlightenment itself. And these four great elders, headed by Mahakashyapa, are, they say, amazed and delighted to learn that there's a further and a higher goal of the spiritual life, namely Buddhahood, the existence of which they had not before suspected. And therefore they say, they feel, as though they had quite unexpectedly acquired an invaluable, a priceless jewel. And they all together in unison, in chorus if you like, give expression to their feelings in a parable. They say that there was a certain man, and he left his father, and he went away. In the East, of course, you usually live with your parents, with your father and your mother, but here only the father is mentioned. So they said a certain man left his father and went away. And he went away into a distant country. And in that distant country he lived many years. The text, which after all is an Indian text, says he lived there 50 years, which is quite a long time, but perhaps that isn't to be taken too literally. And while the son was away, far away, all those years, the father didn't remain idle. Apparently he was a businessman, so he set to work, engaged in various trading ventures, and eventually he became very rich. He also, in fact, was moving around from place to place and eventually settled in another country, all the time growing richer and richer and richer. But the son didn't do so well. Apparently he hadn't inherited his father's brains. Just a few weeks ago I was reading a very interesting report, into the intelligence of the children of above average intelligence parents. Apparently this report had discovered, or the people making the report had discovered, that if you are, as a parent, of more than average intelligence, your children will probably be not nearly so intelligent as you. They will tend to revert to average. And in the same way, if you are, as a parent, below average intelligence, your children will tend to be around average. They'll be more intelligent than you. So this maybe explains quite a number of things in our social and cultural life, but we're not going into that now. But maybe that sort of thing was noticeable even in ancient times. Whereas the father, due to his intelligence and drive, grew rich, the son, all those years, remained miserably poor. Not only was he poor, but he was living in a very despicable, one might even say, a very despicable sort of way. He was just roaming around, searching for the bare necessities of life, doing a job here and a job there, just for the sake of food and clothing. That was all he ever had, food and just the clothes he stood up in. But all this time, the father was just heaping up riches. The text gives a very lavish sort of description. The father apparently was heaping up gold and silver and jewels and grain, and he had lots of slaves and men servants and women servants and workmen and journeymen, and he even had lots of elephants, because in the East, in India and Ceylon, if you possess elephants, well, you really are rich. And horses and cows and carriages and sheep, and also lots of dependents and followers. Because in the East, even now, if you get even a little money together, all sorts of people will start gathering and clustering around you. You'll have a whole string of dependents and parasites very quickly. And this man's business activities apparently spread far and wide. And the text concludes a very graphic description of his activities by saying that he does great things in business, money lending, agriculture and commerce. Ending the description in this way with a sort of flourish. So that the father became, we may say, a sort of merchant prince of the old type and lived in the old traditional style. But all the time, the parable says, or the elders say, all the time, despite his growing wealth, despite all his business activities, the father was all the time thinking of his son. Not only thinking of his son, but he was feeling very sad, very sorrowful. He was pining for his son. He wanted very, very much to see his son again, to know how he was. Not only that, but he was reflecting that the years are going by, and every year I'm getting older and older and older, and I'd like, before I die, to hand over all my riches, all that I've gathered, all that I've accumulated, all that I've earned. I'd like to hand all this over to my son, to my only son. But the son, meanwhile, had just been roaming from place to place to place. From this town, we're told, to the next. From this district to the next. This kingdom to the next. So he was roaming far and wide. But eventually, it so happened that in the course of his wanderings, quite by accident, without any intention on his part, he came to the place where his father was living, where he had settled down. But of course he didn't know that his father was at that time living there. And as he was passing, or rather skulking through the streets, keeping a lookout for the odd job so he could get a few coppers together and buy some food, he saw an enormous house, an enormous mansion in fact, and sitting in the door he saw what seems to be a very rich man. He was surrounded by an enormous company of people, all waiting on him, or waiting for him. Some had bills in their hands, and others had great bundles of money that they wanted to give him, and others had presents, and maybe some had bribes. And they were all standing around, and this rich man was sitting in the gateway on a magnificent throne, and even the footstool, we're told, was ornamented with gold and silver, and he was handling, so the text says, millions of gold pieces, sort of running his fingers through them apparently, and someone was standing behind him fanning him with a chauri, that is to say, with a yak's tail, which in India is one of the symbols of royalty and divinity. So you'd only be fanned with a chauri if you were a very, very rich man indeed and had been exalted practically to the plane of divinity. Not only that, but he was sitting under a magnificent canopy of silk, and this canopy was inlaid with pearls and flowers, and it was hung all round with garlands of jewels. So he really was a magnificent sight. And in the East, of course, even today in some areas, rich people do make this sort of public display of their wealth. It's sort of expected of them. So when the poor man saw this, when he saw this rich man seated there on his throne, in his gate, in all this sort of state, he was terrified, very, very afraid. He thought that he'd come upon maybe the king, or at least some great nobleman. And he thought, well, there's no place for me here. I'd better be off. I'm much more likely to find food and clothing, he thought, in the streets of the poor. And in any case, if I stay, I may be forced to do forced labour. You can get an idea from this passage of the social and political conditions of the time. So he therefore hurried off to escape. Of course, he doesn't recognise his own father in that rich man. But the father, however, recognises him. So many years have gone by, he's much older, he's dirty, he's wearing miserable clothes, covered with dust. But as he stands there gaping at the rich man, the father, recognises him. At first sight, we're told, he knows, that is my son. He recognises him instantly. And he feels very, very happy. He feels really overjoyed that after all these years, 30, 40, 50 years it must be, and at last my son has come back to me. Now he thinks, I can die in peace. There's nothing more left for me to do. Just hand over all my riches to him and die happily, knowing that he is all right and that he will inherit all my wealth. So he calls two or three servants and he says, run after that poor man who was standing there just now and bring him back. So the messengers go running off after him. But the poor man, he becomes more terrified than ever. He thinks that they've been sent to seize hold of him, to arrest him, that he's probably going to be dragged to the place of execution and have his head cut off. So he's so afraid, so terrified, that he falls down to the earth in a dead faint. He passes out. So the father, of course, the rich man, is rather surprised. But anyway, he tells the messengers to let the poor man alone. And he realizes that the poor man is very low-minded, one may say, that he's not used to be in contact with the rich and the powerful. And he comes to realize that, though he is his son, there's a tremendous psychological difference between them, because he's been living in riches all these years, and the son has been living in poverty, in a very low and humble sort of way indeed. But all the same, he feels, well, this is my son, never mind. However low he might have sunk, he's still my own son. But he thinks that, the situation being as it is, it would be better if he didn't tell anybody that that was his son. Better if he just left things as they were for the time being. So after a while, he calls another servant, and he says, you go to that poor man, the one who's just fainted and who's just recovered, and you tell him he's free to go wherever he likes. He can just be off. So when the poor man heard that, he could hardly believe his ears, could hardly believe his good luck, so off he went without any delay. And he found his way into the poorest quarter of the town, and he hunted around again in search of food and clothing. Well, the rich man now has recourse to a trick. He calls two more of his men, and he chooses them very carefully. They're very dark, unattractive, humble in appearance, not very nice to look at, a bit shabbily dressed. And he says to them, you go, you follow that poor man, and you hire him in your own name to work for me. And you offer him double wages to work in my house, in my mansion. So what is the work that the poor man is to be hired to do? He's to help the other two men in clearing away a huge heap of dirt that has accumulated at the back of the mansion. So the two shabbily dressed men, they go to the poor man, they make the proposal, it's accepted, and the three of them work together every day, shoveling that heap of dirt and removing it in baskets on their back to a distant place. And the poor man takes up his abode in a hovel of straw, not very far away from the mansion. So the rich man, looking through the window of his room, can see in the distance the hovel of straw where the poor man is living. And it seems very strange to him that he, the father, should be staying in this beautiful mansion, and the son staying so near, in this hovel of straw, not knowing that he's so close to his own father. So one day, after quite a long while, the rich man, the father, puts on old dirty clothes, and he takes a basket in his hand. And in this way he manages to approach the poor man, his son, and actually to have a little chat with him. And he tells him what sort of work he should do, tells him not to work anywhere else, promises to give him extra money, and says if he needs any sort of old thing, or a pot, or a jug, or anything like that, or a bit of extra grain, well, he should just ask for it. And he said, in any case, I've got an old cloak in the cupboard, I'll give you that if you like. And he says, don't worry, you've been working well, I'm quite pleased with you, you seem sincere, you seem honest, devoted, not like some of these other men I've got. So you just think that, well, after all, I'm an old man, you just think I'm like your own father, just look to me as your father, and I'll treat you just like my own son. So in this way, the parable goes on, things proceeded for quite a number of years. The poor man, the son, continued clearing away the dirt from the back of the mansion every day. And he got into the habit of going in and out of the mansion, the rich man's house, every day without any hesitation at all. But he continued to live in his old hovel of straw. Now again, after a while, the rich man felt sick. And he started feeling that he was soon going to die. So he called the poor man, his son. He said, look, you're very trustworthy now. I regard you as my own son. I'm going to hand over to you the management of all my affairs. You be my manager, my steward. You do everything on my behalf. So from that day, the poor man was the manager, was the steward, and he became familiar with all the rich man's affairs, all his money, his investments, his trade, his transactions, everything. And he used to go as before freely in and out of the mansion. But he continued to live in his own old hovel. And he continued to think that he was poor. Because even though he was handling all this wealth, it wasn't his, it was his master's, as he thought. He himself remained poor. So all the time the rich man was watching him, watching his reactions, watching his attitudes. And he saw that bit by bit over the years the poor man was becoming accustomed to riches. He was used to handling riches. And he saw that he was becoming a bit ashamed that in the past he'd lived so miserably and been so poor. And the rich man saw that the poor man had started wanting to be rich himself, had started wanting to be like the rich man. Now, by the time this stage of the story had been reached, the rich man was at the point of death. He was very, very old and very weak indeed, and he felt he was not going to pass away. So he thought the time is ripe. He sent for the poor man, he sent for all the people in the city, sent for the king's representative, sent for all the merchants, his friends, his distant relations, ordinary citizens, country folk from round about, and he presented the poor man, his steward, to them, and he said, he's not really my steward, he is my own son. And he told them the whole story of what had happened. And on the spot he handed over his wealth to the son. And the son, of course, was amazed and rejoiced in his good fortune that so unexpectedly, in such a remarkable way, he had become rich.